Welcome back to the Big Green Politics Podcast. It's really good to be back with a news episode after not recording one for like 3 months, I think.
Since July, to be exact. But there's been so much going on. To be honest, we didn't know where to start. And we actually sat down today to record a news episode covering the latest green wave from September and October. But then we realized we have 3 episodes worth of content. So that's what we're doing today.
Yeah, we were like, we're not going to hit them with a 3-hour episode. Yeah.
No.
They don't need that. No.
No. That's like the most unclickable thing. So that's what we're doing today. We're recording the first one.
Mm-hmm. This episode's going to be about the mayoral elections in Bogota, Colombia, and also what's going on in Hawaii with the TMT protests. And then in the next couple of weeks, we're going to cover the recent elections in Portugal, Switzerland, and also talk about Central Europe's Green Leap Forward.
We're also going to follow up on my interview with Abhijit Monet on the Canadian federal elections in the next couple of weeks.
Yes, and if you didn't check out that interview, listen to it. It's so great.
Thank you.
It was mostly Abhijit that provided the good content.
As usual. That's what this podcast is all about.
No, but seriously, it was, yeah, brought up some really interesting issues around institutional racism, and also something that we're going to cover in the upcoming episodes about the electoral voting system and democracy and how important that is actually to the Green movement.
Yes, and very relevant right now, considering there will be general elections soon in the UK, and yeah, it'll be held under the first-past-the-post system. Okay, great news from Colombia. Local elections were held in the country on the 27th of October. And in Bogota, the capital city, the candidate from the Green Alliance Party, Claudia López, got elected. Claudia getting elected is important for several reasons. She's a Green. She is now the mayor of Bogota, which is basically the second most important political position in the country, obviously after the presidency. And she's the first female and lesbian mayor the city has ever had. Now, when I was prepping for this segment, I was doing some Googling, as we do, and I was just shocked because I looked at the first 13 articles about her and her getting elected, and all of them had the words female or woman and lesbian or gay or even homosexual in their titles. Like, don't get me wrong, those things should be in the title. Because it is important that she's all those things, and we should say it because substantial representation really matters. And all those media outlets, which include media platforms like the BBC and Al Jazeera, emphasizing the fact that she's basically the, you know, diversity candidate, shows us that anything that's not white, straight male, just like her main opponent, existing in the political scene, political arena, is just an anomaly.
Mm-hmm.
Like, have you ever seen a title on a political media platform saying, white straight male elected as president, or like another political post?
Yeah, it's so true. When you compare it like that, it's true. It makes you realize how much, when they're elected, it's straight away on their substance and content, right?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, what was their platform? What's their policy? What's their plan? So you straight away get to who they are as a politician.
Exactly, because that's the normal. And there is nothing about their identity that stands out as a marginalized aspect of the story, which would make the story interesting and the title interesting, and it'll get more clicks.
Mm.
And I do understand that. I understand when the journalists just want the article to be clicked, so they want to have interesting titles.
Mm.
But then some of them ended up missing what they actually should include about what she's done in her career.
Yeah.
You know? They forgot to include that she's a Green, just like you said.
Mm-hmm.
Or she is a journalist turned politician.
Mm.
She had a great career. She was a senator for the Green Alliance and candidate for vice president in the last presidential elections.
Oh.
Yeah, she's not like 3 degrees.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
She's busy.
She's busy.
She's been busy.
She's been really busy. Like, she went to Columbia University, Northwestern in Chicago, doing public administration, urban politics, a doctorate in political science. None of that. Mm. And when I was also reading these articles, I tried to see or find out what her platform was. Like, she's a Green, but we know that Green can be a lot of different things.
Yes, especially in Latin America, right? I mean, Green parties, exactly. Like we touched on this in our Mexico episode, it's not quite clear-cut, the Green Party movement.
Exactly. And also, she's doing local politics, at least right now, and that can really change. Like, we've seen the message the Greens and the Prince on the Prince Edward Island gave was slightly different than the message the federal Canadian Greens gave in the federal elections.
Yes.
They kind of catered and formed their political message around the need and the demand of the local people, their voters on the Prince Edward Island.
Yeah.
So it can be the same thing here. So I, as someone, as a Green, I see this on social media that she's gotten elected. I want to see what kind of Green she is.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to see Green politics and how it looks like in Colombia, in Bogota.
Yeah. Yeah. And why she managed to get this swell of support behind her. And she also got, you know, the best result in Colombian history, the highest proportion of votes for the mayor in history. So, you know, what happened? I mean, that's an astounding victory. What's also interesting to talk about is the incumbent, who is called Enrique Londoño. He's from a party called Radical Change, and that party has been regularly troubled by criminal or corruption cases. So the fact that this new mayor, I mean, she calls herself incorruptible, right?
Yeah, her big thing was anti-corruption in these elections.
Yeah.
That was her main platform. But also, not only she campaigned on a platform of anti-corruption, but she talked about so many different things. Like, she campaigned on a platform of fighting child labor and improving the city's air quality, guaranteeing free higher education to students, combating xenophobia, building a metro line, reforestation of the Thomas van der Hammen Reserve. And her message was like a message of hope.
Yeah.
She was criticizing the right-wing politicians when she gave that kind of a message. So when we look at her platform, it is quite green.
Mm.
There's a parallel between her platform and some of the local politicians, local Greens that ran here in Europe.
Mm.
Like this message of hope, criticizing the right-wing, anti-corruption, combating xenophobia. But the fact that media talks about women, people of color, and the members of the LGBTQ plus community by putting them into this diversity box and mentioning them as an anomaly, which, you know, marginalizes them, creates this narrative that this is not normal, them getting elected, them being in politics.
Yeah.
And imagine next time people are voting for someone like Claudia, how are they going to vote for that person feeling like they're part of this abnormal situation?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. It's like focus that we've seen on Claudia, even though it's so wonderful that she will be mayor of Bogota and that representation is so important. It's kind of done the same as when we focus on women's, you know, appearance, when they're trying to talk about something, when we should be focusing on their content.
Exactly. Well, all those articles, I think, were written from a supportive standpoint, supportive perspective.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that when there is an identity involved, which is anything than white straight man or male, then you just end up writing about the identity. And you don't focus on all of those cool things that they do and what they represent. But when it comes to the default, the majority demographic, which is not the identity then, it's all of those white straight men's amazing skills and talents and what they do.
Yeah, that vision.
Exactly. But, you know, substantial, we've been saying substantial representation matters. And when I looked at all those articles, 95% of them were written by white men.
In a way, what's been most obvious in hearing about this news is that the press is dominated by white straight men, because clearly this is the thing that most jumps out to them.
Exactly.
And if the press was dominated by gay women, that wouldn't be news.
Exactly. They would say, yes, this great gay woman just got elected and this is what she's done.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think it's also significant that she's center-left and that she's anti-corruption, because the current president, Ivan Duque, who got elected in 2018, he's very conservative. He stood partly on a platform of being against the peace agreement signed with the FARC in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
So she's really representing, and I guess this is often the case, the capital city of a country will often represent a much more kind of liberal, progressive, radical side to the country than the national government.
Exactly, that conflict between local politics in a progressive city and the federal government. Like, we just seen how that plays a role in Turkey, even though Istanbul is not the capital city, but it is, you know, the biggest and one of the most progressive cities in Turkey. And the candidate from the leftist party got elected as the mayor of the whole city. But then you have Erdogan as the president.
Yeah.
A very similar thing happened here.
Yeah, and it's kind of adding to this turmoil and change, I guess, we can see in Latin America at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Just feels like so much is going on and there's so many movements and processes and kind of reckonings happening, like these huge inspiring protests in Chile.
Mm-hmm.
They actually just cancelled COP25 because of it, actually.
Oh my God, no.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh my God.
The Chilean government was like, we need to focus on, you know, sorting ourselves out and restoring order. Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Oh my God. All those organizations that like book tickets, flight tickets and hotel reservations.
Yeah. And it's also quite a blow to the Chilean Greens and organizations and stuff, because
of course,
it's such a like a mobilizer of like energy and activism if when COP comes to you.
I mean, Poland is the best example of that, right?
Yeah, exactly.
They had COP24 there last year in December, and then the Greens and mobilization around the climate crisis has gotten so much momentum since then.
Yeah.
And then now we see Greens in the parliament, which we will talk about in the next couple of weeks.
Save it.
Save the content.
So that's happening in Chile, and then in Venezuela, like we've already talked about, the economic and political crisis it's going through. And then Bolivia's seeing a lot of unrest because the 20th of October elections are contested. Yeah, and then we've already talked about Mexico as well and its new leftist president who represents hope on the one hand, but also a real continuation of like growth-centered, unecological leftist politics in Latin America. Bolsonaro, of course, in Brazil, who...
My guy.
your favorite guy. Represents the opposite in a way of what Lopez stands for, not only because she's a gay person and a woman, both like separately, but also because she's a green, because she's an anti-corruption activist, because she's center-left. In Nicaragua as well, we've seen some really disturbing crackdowns in the past couple of years and moves towards authoritarianism by the supposedly Sandinista government. And as we've covered in a previous episode, which you should definitely listen to, we also have the Mercosur trade deal, this huge passing through the EU member states and the South American countries to be ratified amidst increasing opposition on all sides. So there's a lot going on in Latin America.
A lot of instability and changes and a lot going on.
And a lot of green activism, not just politically, but also in terms of like indigenous resistance to environmental destruction. Something that we're also seeing in Hawaii right now. The TMT protest in Hawaii at Mauna Kea, which is the tallest mountain in the world from base to peak. And it's also a sacred site for Native Hawaiians.
There are other places astronomy can exist. There's no place else for us.
We have nothing against the science or against a telescope. You know, it could be anything that they're building on top of the mountain.
Our religion is very environmentally connected. You need to know your environment really well. Those are our Akua, or our gods.
Our gods are living, touching, elemental forms that are the land, that are the mist, the rains. Kahopuakani, Waihuakani, Kapiku Kapu o Waiyau.
Okay, so what happened is since July of this year, hundreds of protesters and allies in Hawaii on the main island have blocked the main road of Mauna Kea, which leads up to the top where this planned telescope is going to be built. And TMT stands for 30-meter telescope, because this will be the largest telescope in the Northern Hemisphere if it is built.
Wait, what does it stand for?
30-meter telescope.
So scientific.
And the TMT is an ELT, which, believe it or not, stands for Extremely Large Telescope.
No.
But I'm just about getting my head around these really scientific, complex acronyms, so bear with me.
We all need PhDs for this shit.
I know. But I worked it out for you guys, and, you know.
Thank you, Julia.
Take you through it slowly.
Thank you.
Okay? Yeah. Extremely Large Telescope.
Extremely large. Like, who named that? Who named that? So why are they protesting?
So their argument is that the place is sacred. You know, they don't want any telescopes on there at all.
Yeah, and this is just another
one. Yeah. And it's the biggest one that has ever been built there. The footprint is going to be 5 football fields wide.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's absolutely huge. So there's also kind of environmental concerns, because there's been accusations of mismanagement of the land in the past by the current observatories, and of waste going into the mountain and not being disposed of properly. So yeah, this is also an ecological fight, because Mauna Kea is home to the largest aquifer in Hawaii, which would be negatively affected by the development of the telescope, most likely. And it's also a habitat for endangered plants and wildlife, which development would threaten further, especially such a huge one.
Yeah.
The University of Hawaii would be in charge of maintaining the telescope, but it has a poor record of managing the land and causing damage and pollution at Mauna Kea. So from the native Hawaiians' point of view, they didn't want any telescopes in the first place. But now this is another telescope imposed upon them.
And it's not even just a few people in Hawaii saying, oh, but what if things go bad? An official TMT document said that the dust and the greenhouse gas emissions from human activity there may impact cultural, botanical, wildlife, and astronomical resources on the mountain. And then some environmentalists also said that shifts to Mauna Kea's climate may accelerate the decline of snowmelt there. So it's a thing. It's been established that there will be some environmental destruction.
Yeah, this topic is so fascinating. I just couldn't stop researching, like, all the different tangents that it took me down. And, you know, it's like the kind of topic
nerd
where but it's like, you know, when you just want to do a bit of research about something at like 8 p.m. and suddenly it's like 2 a.m. and you've got 76 tabs open on your laptop.
That's you with all research topics, though.
Yeah, that's true. But this was like especially interesting, and it's a part of the world that, even though we always hear nonstop about the US and their politics, we hear nothing about Hawaii and Hawaiian politics, even though it is a part of the US.
It's kind of like Puerto Rico.
Exactly. Just to give you a bit more information about the telescope itself. So this would be the largest telescope in the Northern Hemisphere, and scientists are like super excited about it, because you'd be able to see further than we've ever seen. You'd be able to reproduce images of stars that are clearer than ever before. So it's a kind of very ambitious project that's been in the works for a long time. There's actually been protests against it since 2014. The context is that there's already 13 world-class observatories on Mauna Kea. And for decades, they've been building more and more telescopes, more and more observatories. And it's quite amazing when you look at the photos, because they're just kind of dotted really quite close together, these huge kind of domes on top of this mountain, because it's the perfect place to observe the stars. It's like, you know, one of the best places in the world to do astronomy, because it's calm, it's clear, it's above the cloud line. In some ways, it's very similar to Standing Rock, in that you've got this kind of native opposition and like physical resistance to this mega project imposed from above, from the state, as well as corporate interests. But in other ways, it's more complicated because it's a scientific project. And in this discourse that we have and that Greta Thunberg also promotes about, you know, science is the good thing. You know, listen to scientists. Scientists know. Where does this fit in? Because this is a scientific project. That's why I think it's interesting to kind of explore and to also talk about as Greens, to talk about actually the ethics of what's going on and the topic that environmentalists can often forget about and scientists. It is the kind of colonial side, the imperialist side, the expansionist side of what they do. Let me take you through the timeline, the construction of the TMT. So in 2014, the TMT's groundbreaking ceremony is disrupted by protests.
Your own land to take care of. So take care of that before you come here and desecrate a sacred site.
Use our own people.
In October 2014, construction is temporarily halted due to a blockage of the road. It's set to resume in 2015, in April, and then in June 2015, but it's blocked both times. Then later in 2015, you have the Hawaiian governor, David Ige, who announces like several changes to the management of Mauna Kea and a requirement for the TMT to be the last telescope built on the mountain and for several older telescopes to be decommissioned. And then you've got the Board of Land and Natural Resources who own the land. They approve it. But then the Supreme Court of Hawaii invalidates the building permits later that year in 2015. Because they rule that the board had not followed due process. And then on October the 30th, 2018, exactly 1 year ago, Supreme Court approved the resumption of construction. And the Hawaiian governor, David Ige, announced that construction would resume in July 2019. And that's when
the protests started. Okay.
Yeah. These years of protest and trying to stop it through legal means, through political means, have culminated in finally just like blocking the road as started in July, physically stopping like lorries going up to construct the observatory telescope. It's been such a huge mobilization. Telescopes have been prevented by activism on Mauna Kea because of exactly this reason. Like a NASA environmental impact assessment from the 2000s stated that from a cumulative perspective, the impact of past, present, and reasonably foreseeable future activities on cultural and biological resources is substantial, adverse, and significant. And this was about the building of another telescope on Mauna Kea. And this is basically the same proposal, but bigger. And with some compromises in terms of promising to pay for the land. But at the moment, the land that the telescopes use, they pay $1 per year for the Hawaiian state.
What? Yeah. $1 per year?
$1, yeah. So one of the compromises that's happened throughout this process of resistance to the telescopes is the project proponents promising to pay more money. But that's not the point here. The point is that there's a limit to what Hawaiian people want on their mountaintop. And that limit has been breached again and again.
Everybody has a limit. You know, maybe your guys' limit, or not you guys specifically, but maybe the government, maybe their limit is 24. You know, maybe their limit is 32. Maybe they want to creep down the summit and build more. And for us, you know, my mom's generation stuff, their limit was one.
Our limit was one.
Yeah. Whoa. Yeah, right? Don't you think that's so
powerful.
Yeah. This is actually about self-determination. They've never had a say, and there has to be a breaking point when it's just enough is enough and people stand up. You also have to look at it in the context of colonialism and of Hawaii's history with the US, which is completely illegal annexation.
Yeah, it's like modern era colonialism with some makeup on it.
Yeah, Native Hawaiians, they just have no choice over what's happening to their land, like to their environment, to their sacred places. I mean, it's a long-standing issue, but that's why there's been this kind of surge of interest and energy. And you've had celebrities like Jason Momoa and like Dwayne The Rock Johnson going to Mauna Kea and like supporting the elders that are there protesting and putting their bodies on the line, literally, and being, you know, carried off by the police.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because it means so much more than just one telescope being built. It's so much more than that.
And it's also, it becomes such, like, on paper, this issue, we're mentioning really big words, colonialism, and it sounds like it's from, you know, hundreds of years ago. But where it's happening, it creates such interpersonal weird dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
The person we just listened to from that clip, he's also an indigenous person living in Hawaii, from Hawaii, and he said he worked for those telescopes on the mountain.
Yeah. That's what struck me as well, is how much, you know, Native Hawaiians are involved in the observatories, like working as rangers, as engineers, lots of the astronomers that work there, Native Hawaiians. So some of them are like caught between, you know, their culture and their identity as Native Hawaiians. But it's also not just about identity. It's about politics and power.
Yeah, like you have to work there because you need to make money and it's your land. So, but then you're also contributing to the work that you're against.
Yeah. And
it's such a personal, like, inner conflict.
Yeah. And I heard some stories that were about, you know, the son was protesting
mm-hmm.
at Mauna Kea and the dad was a policeman. And the dad was like, "How are you doing, son?" You know, and they were asking each other how they were. So it's like within families, this is a conflict.
And that dynamic, that inner personal conflict, you can change the place, the scenario, the people involved. But that dynamic, modern era colonialism and what that does to people is the same everywhere.
Mm.
Different levels, but that dynamic is there.
I think for many Native Hawaiians, this is kind of the breaking point.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is just where they just decide enough is enough. Even if they support the fact that there's some telescopes and observatories there, and they're kind of proud of that. One of the most impressive people I've come across, she just pops up everywhere that you're kind of researching this topic, is Kalioha Pishodi.
Mm-hmm.
And she's the spokesperson for Mauna Kea Huia, which is one of the organizations opposing the telescope. And she actually worked as a telescope technician and operator on Mauna Kea.
Mm-hmm.
And she, there's an interview that I'll post below with her. And she's saying, you know, "I've never changed my mind about astronomy. I believe it's a noble endeavor." But she's saying that this now is actually the just the expansionist philosophy. So this isn't about being pro anti-science. It's kind of about power and self-determination.
Yeah, and it's not even, again, referring to that clip. The person was saying our limit was one, and now we're many telescopes later, we're still talking about this, and we talk about a new one. And it's just like that feeling of not being listened to.
Yeah.
And we see the exact same dynamic in different countries with indigenous people. In this case as well, some authorities proposed guidelines for consulting with the people from that land. But the word consulting, when I see that, and it's about indigenous people and the government and the relationship between them,
it
just irks me every single time. And it also reminds me what happened in Canada.
Yeah, what the tar sands.
Exactly, when the Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said, "Yeah, but like we're going to consult the indigenous peoples."
Mm.
And before we pass the bill for the expansion of a huge pipeline project, which is going to release a lot of greenhouse gas emissions, like they consult, but they don't have to comply.
Yeah, yeah, it can be completely meaningless.
Yeah.
What, you listen to why people don't want it, and then you just do what you want anyway.
It's so symbolic.
Yeah.
So that like checked. It's like a to-do list, and you just check it and move on to the next step. Which is, the next step is usually white guys in the parliament passing that bill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What needs to be mentioned is that there's another proposed location for the TMT on the Canary Islands. That's their plan B. And there's been no protest there about the proposed plan. So why not just have it there, you know?
Yeah, I was thinking about the same thing. Why not just, maybe there is another complication. Maybe it's probably like more expensive and not convenient.
Yeah.
For those white men that vote for it.
Oh my God, you're white. You're already going for
this,
it.
The theme of this episode is me losing all of my white male followers on Twitter.
It's also that the U.S. I mean, this is a billion-dollar project.
Oh, really? Did not see that coming.
And it's funded by, like, China, India, Canada, Japan, and a nexus of, like, really, you know, powerful universities and research organizations. And so the U.S. really wants to keep it on its own land, in inverted commas. It brings up the question of, you know, would we build something on the Sacré-Cœur? Would we build something on the Notre Dame?
Can you imagine in like 3 years, Canada contacts the Pope and be like, my guy, you need to kind of leave that place because we're going to actually have a huge pipeline and a telescope on top of it.
Yeah, yeah. It's so a really good place to have a telescope on top of the
On that cathedral? Dome, the Vatican.
What's it called?
So religious, both of us. But can you even imagine that happening?
No way. And it's not only like, it's partly because it's an indigenous, like non-Abrahamic religion, but it's also because it's like in our Western mentality, we can't comprehend that something is sacred if there's nothing on it, if it's just land, if it's just nature.
It's also, I think, destruction is a huge part of colonialism.
Mm.
It's not just expanding. It's not just getting people and, you know, enslaving them. It's destruction.
Yeah.
You know, like it destroys things.
Yeah.
And culture and places and people.
Yeah.
It's a huge part of it. I don't think it's just a consequence of it. It's one of the fundamentals about colonialism. And that's exactly what's happening here.
Yeah. When Hawaii was illegally annexed by the US, like in a coup, a law was passed in Hawaii that required that English be the only medium and basis of instruction in all public and private schools. And it prevented the Hawaiian language from being taught even as a second language. The Hawaiian language and culture has been suppressed, as well as like destruction of their environment.
It's a pattern. It's not just one single individual instance.
Yeah.
You know, it's not science. Like, this project is for science, but it's a part of a pattern.
Yeah, and we're seeing that's how it's being framed in the media, right? It's their kind of, oh, native beliefs versus science, or like modernity versus the sacred, or science versus the sacred. It's this idea that there's a kind of rational, objective thing to do, and then there's just these like irrational, emotive people, kind of slightly wacky.
It's just superstitious native people with their mountains.
Yeah.
How dare they, our white science, need to be there as well? Mm-hmm. What do you mean? But yeah, who is media? Like, it's really bunch of writers, bunch of editors that may frame something in such a way that it genuinely changes the perspective of, you know, people from other countries, people in Hawaii.
Kialoha Peixote that I mentioned before, she mentions in one of the videos that actually native Hawaiians, when they came to Hawaii, navigating from other parts of Polynesia, like more than 1,000 years ago, they were using the stars to navigate long before astronomy was a discipline in the West.
Mm-hmm.
So she doesn't see this as native prejudice almost, or native ignorance against this like human desire to understand the world and the cosmos. That's not at all mm-hmm. the case.
I don't see the story as a very nuanced one.
Mm-hmm.
If you can look up the stars in the sky from that far away with that kind of technology, you can do that without being on the top of that mountain. Or you can just do it with just one telescope or two telescopes.
Mm.
I think it's just pushing because you have a quote-unquote vulnerable community that you found a way to make so. And took all power from them. You know, there's Plan B, there are all of those things.
Mm.
And it's just really like no one would do this to the places that you mentioned, or like Vatican. No one would do that there. And it would sound so ridiculous. But it doesn't sound really ridiculous when you say, oh, these native people, and then they're like weird beliefs. I mean, this is science, you know, we're gonna check out the sky. It doesn't sound, even if you don't frame it that way, it doesn't sound weird. But that's the thing. That is exactly the thing. There are so many other options. Like, I think they did it in New Zealand. They gave this particular land and river a legal person status. I think it was Mount Taranaki. They can, like, Hawaii can do the same thing by granting Mauna Kea a personhood, which would grant the place the legal rights of people to be healthy and protected. Like, there are so many things that they can do, but it's that destruction. No, let's just vote for it. Supreme Court, vote for it. Let's go.
Yeah.
Let's go. Build it. Gas emissions, waste, you know, it's just that that progressive mindset.
Yeah.
Yeah, we need to be more, we just need to be closer to the sky. We just want to get 2 feet closer. We just need to do this.
Yeah.
No, figure out how you can do it without being on that mountain.
Yeah.
You have so much funds. Maybe that should be the project of those university students. You know, learning how to do your own shit without destroying other people's stuff on Earth. To see, do you realize how ridiculous that sounds?
Yeah.
You're destroying something on this planet to see the sky, the stars, the other planets slightly differently, slightly better than how much you were able to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That sounds ridiculous when you put it like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's totally. Just, I'm done. I'm done.
In light of this, our green of the episode is Kialoha Peshora. She is president of the Mauna Kea and Naina Hou. She was also 2016 Green Party senator candidate. And here she is talking about Mauna Kea.
Mauna Kea is actually our origin place.
Kialoha Peshora took us to her family's altar, or lele, one of hundreds of native Hawaiian stone shrines that dot the mountain.
We still bring offering here. These are remnants of offering from people from around the world, actually.
Her Polynesian ancestors were the first navigators, using the stars to find their way here in small boats more than 1,000 years ago, celebrated in the latest Disney movie, Moana.
At night we name every star. We know where we are. We know who
the star knowledge of our people has helped the Polynesian people circumnavigate the globe, you know, millennia before, you know, most of the discoverers were doing it.
All right, folks, that's our show. You can follow us and show us some love on Twitter at Big Green Pulp Pod. You can find us on any podcast apps, iTunes, Spotify, and SoundCloud.
And if you want to help us make green politics more accessible, subscribe and support us by leaving us a rating or a review. Thank you so much, and see you soon.